Hey everybody, James Kirkpatrick here, and I'm here with Barton and Elizabeth Cockey to discuss their new book, The Sacred Fury. How are you guys doing today?
Well, James, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And I'm well also.
Well, you're some of the few, because it does seem that the civilization is crumbling if you just look outside, especially in the place where this book is taking place, in Baltimore. I mean, what do you think is happening to our society right now? It does seem that this is something that just goes beyond mere political conflict.
It is going on beyond that. It's. I think that there's a dark side that's trying to take over humanity for its own wicked ends. I think that we're being maneuvered around by psychopaths like Bill Gates, George Soros et al., on up through to the Rothschilds and Rockefellers, and on up from that. I think that there's a big, I think they want to take down especially the United States and our way of life and train us with the mask, through the masks, to be sheep.
Yes, this is just the whole mask thing is just the latest wrinkle, the latest ploy in their attempts to dominate the world and shut everybody down, make everybody little cogs in their global machine. And the villain in our story, Klaus Pichnos, does bear some resemblances to Soros, but other differences. And I think that people operating at his level near the top of the pyramid are mostly psychopaths. I don't think that they're motivated by any kind of quest for social justice. I think social justice is just a tool in their hands to set different peoples against one another.
It is. They're pitting black against white, everybody against everybody else, basically. I mean, you can't go into a store. Let's go into a store without a mask and not have somebody come up and scream at you because, where's your face covering? Don't you care about others? And I say to them, no, actually. But what I do say to them when they come up when I don't wear a mask is this. They'll say, where's your mask? And I say, disabled. And that shuts them down immediately. So if anyone out there listening wants to shut somebody down, that's the word.
That gives you, well, you can take one of two choices in dealing with these people. That is to say, with the true believers who have come up to you. One is to take moral high ground, in that case, being more disabled than someone else. And the other is simply to indicate that you really don't care what they think. And either one works.
But I think the moral high ground.
The moral high ground works better because it definitely shuts them down.
Try it sometime. Just say disabled. It'll stop all conversation. Try it.
Well, one of the things that really intrigued me about this is that you combine these supernatural elements with a dystopian political future. Some may say present. You've talked about some of the influences, but did you draw inspiration from any source in particular? And also, considering the book's setting, Edgar Allan Poe, what was his influence on this?
Well, first of all, I'm from Baltimore, so...
It
was convenient, and Poe, of course, has strong attachments to Baltimore and Baltimore to Poe.
And to the supernatural, because he wrote about that in one of his last writings.
Yes, in his, he wrote about it in the one called Eureka, which was a...
Right.
Kind of not just metaphysical, but also astronomical and mathematical story that's almost unreadable, but he considered it to be his greatest work.
I mean, here's what he said. I care not whether my work be read now or by posterity. I can afford to wait a century for readers when God himself has waited 6,000 years for an observer. I triumph. I have stolen the golden secret of the Egyptians. I will indulge my sacred fury.
Wow. That's remarkable that he considered that his most important work. It reminds me of Sir Isaac Newton, who, you know, of course, invented calculus and did all these things.
Yeah.
But he himself thought his writings on alchemy and things like that were the things he would be remembered for.
Right.
I mean, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I think you've kind of answered it for me directly, but given that this is Halloween, do you literally believe there is a spiritual world that intersects with the physical?
There is absolutely, undoubtedly, a spiritual world that intersects more than one. There's lots of different realities. There's many realities, many different dimensions. I think what's going on now is that we're getting ready to make an evolutionary jump from the third dimension, which is where we are here, to the, I think the fifth and the fourth dimension are intersecting at this point. The paradigm of how things have been running for the last 10,000 years is shifting, is changing. Have you noticed everything is getting faster and speeded up and crazier, and you don't really know which way's up or down anymore? It's things are changing. The paradigm is changing. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, from a purely materialist perspective, a lot of people have been writing about how technology, particularly the merger of technology with human beings, will fundamentally change what it means to be human. So you could say, well, there's this evolutionary leap coming, but it has nothing to do with spirituality or something supernatural. It's just a function of growth in technology. You would argue that it's something bigger than that, right?
I think it's technology and AI, again, is the dark side, against the light side that's coming in.
Against humanity. And actually, this brings us back to one of the other inspirations for the book, which is C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis wrote an essay called The Abolition of Man, in which he talked about much the same project that the left is engaged in now, but his imaginative, fictional exploration of the same themes came in his Perelandra trilogy, and specifically in the last book of that trilogy, which was called That Hideous Strength. And we drew inspiration from that book as well.
And he wrote that around the time of World War II, I believe. Shortly after. And they were really worried about that dark side, that element coming through. It was embodied by the Nazis, shall we say, at that time, or Germany or Hitler. And that's a story where he has Merlin come back and save everybody. And in our sequel to The Sacred Fury, what's great about, well, we were writing along and it got so crazy, we're thinking we're creating the future through the books, and we stopped writing it. But then we had this inspiration, and we have a space alien, a messenger, crash lands through a Stargate in Argyle, New York, okay, upstate New York. And he kind of crashes through the Stargate and kind of like ends up in a wreck, because he's come from one dimension into this one. And he's found by the little guy, Joe, the little kind of semi-retarded guy.
Who starts the story.
He's brought back and they revive him. Well, why he's there, and here's why the second book, The Triumph of Good, is so wonderful. It's the answer. He's come to save us, to bring us home again, to bring us through that Stargate into a better dimension, beyond all this crazy AI stuff and control. And
meanwhile, in the next book, there are other interesting characters developing their own approach to things, which is not in a spiritual line, but in a more material line, attempting to oppose the dark side directly. So there are two different approaches going on simultaneously.
Well, I've always been intrigued by stories about where you merge the supernatural with growth of technology. I guess one of my favorite horror movies is Event Horizon, if you've ever seen that, where the plot is that a spaceship uses some sort of technology to go through a wormhole, but it actually ends up in some different dimension and comes back and brings all this evil with it. When you talked about, you know, writing this sequel, where you thought that you were almost like manifesting actual things happening. John Carpenter had a movie like that too. I think it was At the Mouth of Madness or something like that. But these themes do seem to be increasingly popular. And one of the things that I've noticed is the merger of this kind of, let's call it occultism, with leftist political organization. For example, you go on Twitter and you see people, you know, without irony, casting spells or putting a hex on President Trump and all this crazy stuff. And you think to yourself, do they really believe it, or is this just a way to troll Christians or something?
Well, they do believe it, and there is a dark side. It's called, you know, satanic worship, and that stuff works. You know, you hear about voodoo and things of that nature. That is real. That's real stuff. That goes on. That has nothing to do with spirituality, though.
We've met people who are involved in that, and they are very dark.
They're very dark. So there's a dark side, and there's the light side. And what they do is very true. I mean, I don't know if you've listened to or read anything by David Icke. David Icke's been banned pretty much from everything these days. He's an
I've heard of him, but I haven't read anything of him, but I've heard of him.
He has a lot he's pretty far out there, but he has a lot of interesting things to say, more or less in tune with space aliens trying to control us, and they want all the vampire stuff, and they need humans because they're going to drink our blood.
Yeah, let me just jump in here real quick. I mean, I think what a lot of people, I mean, again, I've never really listened to the guy or read any of his stuff or anything, but from what I know, a lot of people will talk about David Icke and say, oh, he's describing things that are happening. You just got to ignore all the stuff about space reptiles and the rest of it. And then you have some people who are like, no, like that stuff is real. So it's a...
The point is that you're saying is there's a lot of stuff out there that people can listen to, and you have to wonder, how do you prove what's true?
Right. I mean, having worked for a long time with evangelical Christians and seeing some of these pastors, I've always been amazed at how concerned some of them are about things you wouldn't really think they would care about one way or the other, like the CERN experiments for quantum physics and talking about all these other manifestations of technology that they think are opening past to the dark side, let us say. That's out there. And that's out there both on the political left and the right. And it does seem that it's not just a mental battle or a physical battle or a political battle, but to a lot of people anyway, it does feel like a real spiritual battle.
Well, it does, and you're going to hear a lot about in the last days, you know, in the Bible. And
yes, right, and it is a spiritual battle, and I think that you're right also that there are people on both the right and the left who are concerned about the negative possibilities opening up by all this technology.
But I think what we have to focus on are the positive elements that are opening up to humanity that can raise us up above all of this horror story that we're listening to on a regular daily basis. I mean, people are afraid for their lives, so much so that they're not living. They'd rather stay in their closet. What if I go out and die? I catch the COVID-19. Well, I think I'd rather go out and take my chances than live a life of being sequestered.
Right. I mean, there's definitely whatever someone believes about, let us say, the more occult elements or spiritual elements or whatever else, just in terms of somebody who's a pure materialist, there are a lot of concerns that technology will change what it means to be human, or that it will allow basically unlimited government or corporate supervision of everything you do. The Chinese social credit system, only even more intensive, and in America, maybe not directed through the state per se, but certainly directed through big tech companies.
And
people just kind of assume that we're being watched now anyway.
I think we are.
We definitely are. I'll tell you an example. When we were writing this book, we were talking about the evil genius Pycnos, and Elizabeth had her cell phone sitting nearby, and we got a little bling on the cell phone. Up pops an advertisement for vacations to the Greek Isle of Pycnos.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories.
Oh my God.
That cannot
be too. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's one of these things that makes you question yourself. Is, you know, am I making this connection because I'm being paranoid or something, or are they actually listening? There have definitely been one or two times where I've said something out loud, and then I go on the computer, and there is a targeted ad for me for this particular thing.
It's true. They have algorithms that are amazing these days. One reason, here's the thing. I would not want to live in a city right now. Barton and I live on a farm here in the North Country, far from the madding crowd. We grow our own vegetables. We have ducks and chickens. We have running water all year long. We have, you know, a fireplace and a wood stove. We're preppers, I guess you'd say that, right? I mean, we're like prepping just in case everything goes straight to hell. We're here.
We've been thinking that things were going to go pear-shaped somehow or other for quite some time.
We just weren't sure exactly how.
We certainly did not anticipate this particular virus thing. That was a very clever coup by the dark side, I would say. It's not that there isn't really a virus, and it's not that medical people like myself have been thinking about the possibility of the big one hitting at some point. What would we do about it? But this clearly is not the big one, but it's being treated like that. So that's. I happen to think, just to get a little off topic, that all the global warming nutters who were trying to get us to live in the dark ages because we're using too much carbon, realized that this long term threat of global warming was too long term, and they needed something much more immediate and immediately threatening. So that's why they came up with the virus.
It's been a brilliant marketing campaign. Truly.
I mean, just to be clear though, what you're suggesting is that they're capitalizing on something that existed.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like the virus itself is obviously real. I mean, I know people who got it, and it's not fun, but they also didn't die. I mean, it was just a very bad week or two.
Right.
And you know, we do have to ask the question. I mean, COVID-19 is a real thing, and it does pose a real threat, especially to certain categories of people, you know, nursing homes and things like that. But the fatality rate is not that. I mean, every death is a tragedy, but it's not particularly fearsome. But it raises the question, what happens if there's another pandemic that has even much more lethality, and our society basically fragmented over just handling this?
Oh, yes. First of all, there's really no plan for backing out of the shutdowns and lockdowns that they've gotten into now, and it looks as if they're diving back into it in Europe.
Yeah, France is implementing a full one, I believe, tomorrow for 4 weeks or something like that. And meanwhile, in France, we also have this issue right now where there were, I believe it was today, some Islamic terrorist attacks, or called as such, by President Macron.
Right, they beheaded someone in church, apparently.
Yeah. There have been some other incidents, and then you also have the diplomatic fight between France and Turkey, which is escalating things.
That's right. I don't see an end game for the mask. I remember when they started this whole thing back in March. Oh, it's only going to be for a couple weeks, just a couple weeks, and we're going to flatten the curve.
Right. Well, the only possible end game is that they're going to force everybody to get a vaccine or not be allowed to do anything.
Right. That's the end game.
And that's...
Well, the question is which one, because you have several companies producing these things, and we've already seen some trials that had to be halted because of side effects and things like that. Interestingly enough, the main political voice that I see saying don't take a vaccine, the vaccine is bad for you, are Democrats from California. They actually seem to be the biggest anti-vaxxers right now, and their argument is that President Trump is accelerating the vaccine development too quickly. It'll be interesting to see if Biden wins, if they instantly flip on that.
Well, they flip very easily on things like that because they really are opportunists. Now, it may very well be that some of the ones in California are genuinely skeptical about vaccines, because I have seen some of the writings from that end of the country that have been supportive of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s efforts. And he strikes me as being, although not someone that I would normally like, an intellectually honest guy who's looked into this matter very seriously. But the first response that the Democrats had was that Trump was being a racist.
Yeah, but the travel bans and everything else. Yeah, that seems to have been entirely forgotten.
Yes, go out and kiss a Chinese guy, and
That was in Italy, right?
Right. So that didn't last long because they're pretty shrewd manipulators. So they say, hey, this is a crisis that we don't want to go to waste.
I have to ask you a question. Would you get the vaccine?
Not immediately, no. As somebody who's looked into a lot of these companies and the way they're accelerating drug development, I mean, here's the question. Let's say you had stage 4 cancer or some other disease that is terminal, and they say, we have this drug. There's a 50% chance it's going to kill you. There's a 50% chance it's going to help you. Will you take it? The obvious answer is yes, because you have nothing to lose. But if you've got something that they rush through development, and it's a question between taking that and not knowing necessarily what's going to happen or what the long-term side effects are, or maybe getting a disease that you have a pretty good chance of surviving without too much trouble, I'm inclined to take my chances at least until the vaccine is out for a while and we can actually see if there are any long-term effects. I mean, we have a process for approving drugs through the FDA. It usually takes years, and they're speeding through this in a year.
Right, right. And we do. And the interesting thing about vaccines, which I didn't realize until recently, is that they're not required to be safe. All other drugs approved by the FDA have to be safe and effective, but vaccines are not required to be safe, and the companies that make them are immunized against liability as long as they list all the possible side effects on the label. And of course, they're very good at doing that.
There's also a lot of, maybe not a lot of talk, some talk on the dark web, shall we say, about what's in this vaccine. And I think Bill Gates has alluded to it, of nanotechnologies that they're able to put into needles and shoot into your body to track us. And somebody said, well, they're already tracking us with our phones. They don't need to do that. And I said, well, I don't know. I'm just saying there's a lot of talk about what else is in the vaccine besides whatever they say is in there.
This would be, if that is true, it would be a clever way of getting that chip into everybody that Pycnos is working on.
Yeah, that's right. Novel. That's right. It would be a clever way. We didn't think of that.
We didn't.
They beat us on that one.
Well, I mean, even, again, just to bring it back to a purely materialist idea, there are two types that are being developed right now. One are the types that modifies DNA. That's the pretty traditional way of vaccines. I mean, I'm the type who gets my flu shot every year. It's never had any bad impacts on me, as far as I know. But what they're doing with these new vaccines for COVID is they're modifying what's called mRNA. And that's something that has never been done successfully yet. Now, I'm not saying they won't be able to do it successfully just because they're throwing so much money at this problem right now, but you do have to ask yourself, this would be the first vaccine of this type ever created, and it's something being rushed through development. Now, again, if you're staring down the barrel of something that's going to kill you, you may take your chances, but if you're looking at something where you've got a pretty good chance of maybe not even having symptoms, you got to ask yourself, do you want to be the first one in line to get this thing?
Well, the other thing is this, the death rate is about the same as the flu. We didn't put on masks for the regular influenza. Right. And the regular influenza, they haven't even gotten a vaccine developed for that.
Well, the regular influenza, they're only right about 20% of the time. I've always refused to get flu shots.
Yeah, we don't get flu shots. We don't get shots, do we? We don't get anything.
Being in medicine, tends to make me more skeptical rather than less.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting because you are speaking from a place of authority on this matter.
Yeah, and we talked to a lot of doctors. I mean, we talked to several individuals in hospitals in Baltimore while all of this was going on, and they weren't full.
Oh, no.
They had to send a lot of people home.
Right. The whole narrative about hospitals being overcrowded has shifted several times.
It has. Did you know, here's a statistic that my son told me, who's in the National Guard in Texas. He said that hospitals, at least in Texas, have to be 85% full in order to be viable, in order to stay in business. So that means you've only got 15% of the hospital left over for, let's say, an event like the COVID-19.
For any emergency.
For any emergency.
I think we might be, one of these days, we're going to be staring down the barrel of something that's even more serious than COVID. I'm not saying like, oh, it's going to be created and unleashed. I'm saying it's just going to happen. And we're already seeing reports of the COVID virus mutating. Apparently, that's what's really hitting people in Europe now. I'm not so sure it's hitting America.
Or somebody somewhere, let's say China, for instance, could be stirring up a whole new potent batch of stuff that they're getting ready to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where I want to pivot to the book after this, but I mean, it's one of these things where to talk about it, I mean, it makes you sound like you're a crazy person, but the bottom line is that everybody pretty much outside China is frustrated with the lack of cooperation that government has made in determining the origins of this thing. And it seems that American and European journalists, they report this, they acknowledge it, but they don't seem too interested in getting to the bottom of it.
I think we're very unlikely to find it out anytime soon, and maybe ever, especially if it was created by American military intelligence and originated with a laboratory in North Carolina that migrated to Wuhan.
And it could have gotten out of the web
accidentally, or prematurely,
before they really had a nice batch whipped up.
Yeah.
So they did the best they could, you know, with the media to scare the hell out of everybody.
Well, again, I mean, initially it was actually President Trump who was being denounced as the authoritarian for the travel ban.
Right.
And everything else. So the original media narrative, and you can go back and see this in the mainstream publications, like they were the ones saying, it's just the flu, don't worry about it, it's fine. It was the kind of populist right-wingers like, well, me being like, hey, this is a big deal. We need to close down migration. We need to do this. We need to do that. Same thing with masks. I mean, it was the right-wingers at the beginning who were saying, hey, you need to wear a mask. This is a big deal. And medical authorities in this country were saying, don't wear masks, it makes things worse.
Yeah.
We need them for medical professionals. And that just flipped on a dime. And it seems like the whole history of what actually happened has also flipped on a dime.
That makes it very hard to tell what's true and what people's motives are, doesn't it?
Yes. Yes, it really is. And, you know, obviously social media censorship and deplatforming makes this far more difficult. I'm not saying that there isn't occasionally disinformation put out there specifically, but generally speaking, the best way to find the truth is have as many sources as possible and make your own judgment, not just have one party line that's shoved on you from the top down, because who's to say they aren't lying?
Well, in fact, that's probably a better bet.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, again, it's one of these things where even to talk about it makes you sound like a lunatic. But, you know, 2 years ago, if I had said, listen, like there's this Jeffrey Epstein guy and there's this whole situation, you'd run screaming in the other direction because you'd say this guy is a madman. But like, this was real, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, you wonder what else is there that we're not finding out about. But I mean, I think that kind of goes into the book here. I mean, you have this combination of real political events, supernatural elements. And so, you know, what really inspired, well, you talked about your inspiration, but where did you get the idea for the general thrust of the story? And maybe you could explain what that story is to our listeners.
God, we sat down one night, we got drunk, and we kind of like threw out some ideas and said, let's make
Vino
this
Veritas.
Yeah. Let's kind of come up with this. And then we wrote it chapter by chapter, and we'd have the dailies in the morning. We'd have coffee and read what we'd written the day before.
Elizabeth is a better storyteller and I'm a better writer. So she would actually write a chapter and send it to me in email and I would sit down and edit it and revise it.
And then it got easier for me just to tell him.
Then it got, well, what happened was that after a while she said, you're changing the whole thing. So it's, I might as well not even be writing it. But what happened at that point was the story started to tell itself.
It did start to tell itself, yeah. In the sequel, we actually get into where in the first book, Pyknos actually dies, is murdered.
We don't want to give away,
we don't want to
much.
Give away too much. But anyway, in the second book, the computer comes back because Pyknos has had his top AI guy program this computer to be him. And now he's running essentially the world, right? And he's got all these programs, A, B, C, always be connected, you know, D, E, F. And it goes on. It has every three letters has some kind of program.
He's rushing the entire – it's actually – this is part of the reason we really got scared about this, because he's rushing this this green agenda or some kind of agenda onto the American people faster than they can respond to it. And at the same time, the streets are torn up with riots. And so it's very much...
Just to bring the listeners into to what you're talking about, the general structure of the story, the idea is that there's this organization which seeks total control, and it starts intervening into the lives of the characters, including some journalists who are basically told what to say. And so this is sort of the overall system that we deal with now. You're sort of encapsulating it into one singular organization that's pushing this stuff down. In the real world, it might be a bit more complicated, but here, like, this is the actor. This is what's doing it.
And part of the idea of this was that we were sitting around thinking about how there are a lot of very, very intelligent, articulate people writing about what's going on in the world. But somehow or other, that doesn't appeal to everybody. It doesn't get through everybody's imagination. And the idea of writing a more imaginative, fictionalized version of what's happening that would crystallize some of these issues in an entertaining format, a kind of dark comedy, would be more effective in reaching certain audiences.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, stories do tend to work better than dry analysis when it comes to capturing the imagination of people.
Right.
Let's get into to some of the specific things in the book. I mean, at one point you have one of the employees of the organization say that the true believers in human equality are just useful idiots. There are some people in the streets demonstrating right now who really believe what they're saying, and who really are striving for what they think is a better world. Do you think that they are just being misled? Do you think that they're negative? Obviously, we also have some people out there in the streets now simply to harm people and smash things and steal things.
That's true. We've got both elements there. I would say, you know, when you hear on the news that 99% of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations are peaceful, at least in upstate New York, that seems to be the case. We see in these little towns, mostly schoolgirls, and occasional pasty-faced white men who look like ministers or something, holding up signs and wearing masks, of course, because that's another part of the virtue signaling, that for Black Lives Matter. And these people...
There aren't any Black people up here.
That's right. That's right. These people sincerely believe that they're somehow standing up for goodness and righteousness and the American way. So they are an example of the useful idiots. And if you confronted them with any kind of argument about it, you'd obviously be a racist because you're countering their ideas.
And they would say, don't you care about your fellow man?
Yes.
What are you going to say? No. Well, I do. But,
you do.
that's another point. But I think there are people that you're alluding to that are probably, these crowds are very well organized. I can't believe that type of person... Right. Has that much ability to administrate that kind of an event without somebody managing that at a different level. And I think they're paid. I think a lot of them are paid.
Yes, the violent
to go out
mobs.
And demonstrate.
Yeah,
the violent mobs.
They're hired gangsters. And many of them are low-level criminals, as we found out. Well, of course, somebody has to shoot a couple of them, so they actually get brought in and investigated. Like Kyle Rittenhouse, was it? Who took down three of them, and
right.
they all turned out to be pretty ugly customers. So, yes, there's that element, some of whom are chronic criminals, but also chronic malcontents and people who were just looking for a reason to beat somebody up.
I definitely think there's an element of nihilism and opportunism in a lot of this. Like, I mean, you see in Philly, I mean, they immediately descend on the Foot Locker and everything else. And it's okay, this is an ideology here.
That's another element. I mean, you've got the little the church ladies and the little girls with the signs.
Right.
Then you've got the thugs who are kind of like the street gangs of the Nazi party or the Bolsheviks or whatever. And then you've got this other element, which is just opportunistic urban undocumented shoppers.
I wonder what's going to happen at Christmas time, if they'll cancel Christmas or they'll just burn it down.
I mean, that's one of the questions, and I don't want to go too far off from the book, but, you know, that is one of the questions that I kind of wonder about, that assume Biden wins, can they just turn this off? Or have they unleashed something they can't really control? Or in contrast, if President Trump pulls off an upset, you know, is this just how it is forever now? They're just going to keep doing this and doing this and doing this, and it'll just go on and on and on every time there's any kind of an incident until the cities basically just become, I'm not going to say uninhabitable, but certainly reversing the progress that was made in the 1990s.
Well, if you look at the last time there were a whole lot of anarchists running around after the turn of the century, especially in Russia, it took them a couple of decades to turn things upside down, but eventually they did. They just kept at it.
And yeah.
I think that the left has just been keeping at it ever since Trump was elected. I don't think they've let up for a day. I don't think he had 10 minutes of basking in his victory before they were tearing him down. I think if he wins, it's going to unleash more mobs, more violence. If Biden wins, I don't know what'll happen then. I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, if I'm a member of, say, Democratic Socialists of America, I want Biden to go down in flames so you can say, hey, look, the Democrats put up this neoliberal establishment guy and he lost. That's why we should be in charge of the party now. But if he does win, I think he won because a lot of hardline progressives basically held their nose and voted for him to get out Trump. But I can't imagine they won't keep pressuring him because they don't see Biden as that much better than Trump to a lot of them. I think the hatred for Trump may be enough to get Biden in, but I don't think he'll have an uneasy time on the throne as well.
I think you're right. And the extreme left is going to keep putting pressure by more and more riots. And it's interesting that Trump doesn't seem to have that much. Well, of course, he's a constitutionalist, right? So he's not going to send in federal troops to the cities without being invited. But the Democrats who are controlling the various cities don't have the will to shut down the riots. And Biden certainly won't, because he's at least ostensibly sympathetic to all of their aims.
Right. I mean, he's done the pro forma denunciations of looting, but he prefaces it by saying these grievances are justified, even in cases where they're clearly not, where you have people going after police with weapons and things like that.
Right. Well, let me read from the book real quickly here what Pickno says about manipulation.
Could you explain the characters to some of the people who have the book yet, just so they're not lost?
Is the evil
the chair? He's the chair. Head of an organization called GOOD, Global Outreach Organizing for Diversity.
Right.
And their goals are pretty much what you might imagine, and they've succeeded in bringing other countries to their knees. And he's working on the United States, and he's working out an agreement with the University of Maryland to build a social justice tower in downtown Baltimore. And
he's taking over the graveyard where Poe is buried from the University of Maryland owns it. And it's kind of an albatross around their neck because they can't do much with it. the graves are always like, they're, when it rains, the graves kind of come up to the surface. They flood, and there's, they have catacombs, and you can't bring people down there because.
So it's
obvious reasons, right?
Yeah, you can't park there. Yeah, it's not safe. So anyway, so they're interested to get rid of it, and this there's another interest that Pyknos has in digging up Poe's grave, because he believes, based on a letter that he's found from the former editor of the Southern Literary Messenger, John Reuben Thompson, describing his last meeting with Poe and what he knows about certain materials that were buried in Poe's grave when he was reinterred.
That are elixirs that give the secret eternal life, because Poe, and this is true, was actually terrified of being buried alive. Back then that happened not infrequently. And he was buried with these elixirs. At least that's what Pyknos thinks. So he wants also the graveyard, because he wants them to dig up Poe's grave and find these elixirs, because he's dying.
Right.
He's dying. And
yeah. In the Great Train Robbery, I remember Michael Crichton did this whole historical dive into the fear of being buried alive during the Victorian era. Yeah, and there were actually some graves with like little bells supposedly if you were trapped in the casket, you could ring. Of course, the problem is if you have, you know, a million things could cause the bell to ring, earth moving or wind or something. So you have all these pretty morbid incidents of people thinking someone's buried alive and they dig him up and it's just a rotting corpse. But very strange time in terms of you had these great advances in science and let's call it secular humanist thought, but you also had this overlap with spiritualism and ghost photography and all these other weird trends that kind of happened around the turn of the last century.
Yeah. And occasional failure to make an accurate diagnosis of clinical death.
Right.
Yeah. So, that is true.
So back to Pyknos for a minute. So his whole deal, and what you were talking about earlier, like who's going to be elected, what are they going to do? Pyknos says he had learned how to crash the economies of small countries for his own profit. It was easy. You persuaded them to go into debt for some extravagant project, an airport, a highway system, etc. And when they couldn't repay, your bank owned the country. Or you crashed the currency through derivatives. Ka-ching. Or you stirred up a revolution or a strike or a civil war. Sound familiar? Setting disparate ethnic groups against each other required so little effort and paid such huge dividends. Ah, diversity is strength for those who can manage it.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And that's what's going on now.
Yeah.
The question I have is how many people are doing this out of a real sense of self-interest, and how many people are doing it, you know, either because they believe in it or just because they don't want to get into trouble. So, for example, in chapter 22, Dylan is told, you know, specifically what to say, what words to use, spew, lashed out, dog whistle. And the question is, journalists now, I mean, they move like a swarm of bees. They all believe the same thing and turn on a dime. And the question is this coordinated, or is just this just the way they are? And every once in a while, you'll see one of them kind of step out of the swarm, usually progressive, honestly, progressive who's not a big fan of neoliberalism or Joe Biden or whatever. And he'll say, well, this isn't true. And then they'll just turn on him, too. So it's not even just political ideology. It's just this almost dogmatic adherence to the narrative that defines journalism today. And I guess my question is, like, do you think that it's conscious or that it's just sort of social dynamics at work or something, you know,
I think
non-materialistic?
I think it's both. It's conscious and it's social dynamics. There, journalists, and we know a few, are very much afraid of losing their jobs, especially if they're young, they have a family. And
not being able to get work somewhere else.
Right.
They'll be blackballed forever.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely true with journalism. I mean, you get cast out once, that's the end.
That's the end. And back to, like, the other side, if an eagle falls into a chicken yard, the chickens will devour it as a group. Yeah. As a group, the chickens will. So you could have a really amazing human being journalist who's saying the truth, but everybody else who's playing by the rules are going to take them down because it's kind of instinctual almost,
yes.
as a group kind of thing. But we know people who really they're terrified that they're going to lose their livelihood, and so they go along.
And they're going along as long as they have to and looking for other career opportunities. So what's happening is that there's a boiling off of more conservative and more intellectually honest people from journalism.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it really doesn't take much skill these days. You're just basically copying a press release and calling it a day.
Right.
Yeah.
So and if you listen, they all say if go on all these TV stations, they all say almost exactly the same words. It's like they read the same script. You can go through hundreds of them, and they all say they're all saying the same thing. Whether it's NBC, ABC, MSNBN, in Germany, France, wherever it's.
Well, I've been struck for a long time by the fact that the news feed is always the same wherever you go. So Reuters or AP or whatever puts out something, but somebody selects that story. Someone decides that that's going to be the lead. And so there's an intelligence at work at a high level also, which is kind of what this is about with Pyknos and Good, crystallizing that into a particular organization. There are groups out there that are looking for incidents such as the shooting of the Skittles chap down in Florida.
Oh, Trayvon Martin, yeah.
Trayvon Martin, yes. And that was, I would say, the first of a series of very targeted outrages about this type of incident. And, you know, this is a country of over 300 million people. Sooner or later, some kind of horrible thing is going to happen anywhere.
But back to Dylan for a minute. What they tell Dylan is if you don't write this article the way we want you to, we're going to take down your landlord.
Yeah.
And they do. They do. Right. They you know, imprison him. So that's what happens. That's the truth. People, if you don't do it, maybe we won't ruin your career, but we'll take out your newborn baby or your best friend or fill in the blank, grandpa.
Yes, I'm sure that it's at a certain level, if the stakes are high enough, and a particular journalist steps out of line, they can really lean on him, even at the highest level of journalism.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was Glenn Greenwald who stepped down from The Intercept today, which I believe is something he founded. Certainly no conservative, very much a leftist, very much someone who is extremely progressive compared to Joe Biden.
Right.
But he's out of line with the narrative, and so they just have no more use for him. I mean, what's one of the things, you know, that just kind of struck me with the overall approach to the book is this idea of the return of the repressed. When we talk about ghosts, when we talk about supernatural, when we talk about the importance of place, it's sort of like a past history and the past works of prior generations coming back and overcoming modernity and all its schemes and all its manipulations. And one of the ways we see that playing out now is the destruction of monuments. I think Dr. Fitzgerald talks about that a little bit, about these monuments. And now we're seeing these things torn down, and it's really a way of tearing a people away from its roots, from its heroes, from its heritage. I mean, what do you see is the significance of that, and what should average people do about it?
Well, I see it as an assault on us as the founding people of America. It's a kind of cultural genocide. And what ordinary people can do about it is to realize that we have a lot more strength than we think we do. It doesn't take a whole lot of people contacting members of a city council or county council to make a difference.
Or just going to a town meeting and standing up and saying, I have an issue with this.
Now, in some cases, as in Baltimore, this was all planned behind the scenes and done in the dark of night. They took
down
four significant monuments, none of which were in any way racist, but of course they always make up this nonsense about it. But the way they did that actually prevented any advanced public discussion. And the governor of Maryland, who's
Hogan,
as a character as you could find in a Republican, actually took down the statue of Roger Brooke Tawney from the statehouse lawn at the same time, and was appropriately criticized for it by Democratic members of the state assembly. So there are cases where you can't do anything because it happens too fast. Then all you can do is try to do something retroactively, but that's often difficult. But in Eastern Maryland, there's still a modest little statue to a Confederate soldier in front of the courthouse. And of course, the usual kinds of people have been trying to get that taken down, but enough people have written in and opposed the removal. So far it's there. The problem is, of course, the left never gives up. They just keep at it. So we shall see how that goes.
Has anyone considered raising money to raise a statue?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that for some time. Might be time to start putting up new stuff. And there have been some successful defenses. I mean, I think the best was probably in St. Louis, where you had Catholics physically protecting a statue of the French king. And I believe even his descendant, the Duke of Anjou, spoke about the need to protect it. I mean, that's his, you know, direct ancestor. So there have been cases where people are fighting back. It's not just this constant retreat. There's been successful defense, but I agree. I think it might be time to start thinking in terms of offense, in terms of creating new things.
You can't fight a defensive war and win.
I don't think it's gotten bad enough for everyone yet to muster a militia of sorts, because what's going on is they've had this, you know, they're being paid, everybody's being paid who's out of work to unemployment, wages are still going on. People have been forgiven, not being able to pay their rent. A lot of that's been happening, which I think has offset what might have been anarchy by now. If enough people are starving, what's going to happen then?
Well, that's true. But just getting back to the issue of the monuments, I think most people have been sleepwalking through this, as through much of everything. One of the scenes in the book has the crowds of spectators lining up to go into the ballpark for an Orioles game, more or less oblivious to the fact that there are rioters outside trying to tear down a statue of Babe Ruth, because he's a guy with a baseball bat, which is intimidating to persons of color. So I think that's a little encapsulated image of what's going on, that most people would rather watch sports ball. Fortunately, that seems to be going the way of all useless things, but would rather watch some kind of athletic event than pay attention to their own history.
That is true. There is a lot more attention to sports than there is to history.
Yeah, it'll be unclear how much longer they can keep that going, though, with the decline in ratings and everything else.
Exactly. I mean, everything. I don't think that the bad guys realize what they're doing. They're tearing it all down. Yeah. Don't they think things are going to be rebuilt locally eventually, that people are going to start going over to each other's houses and going, let's drink some beer, some brewskis over at Bill's house in the basement, and that becomes a speakeasy automatically, or you're going to get your tomatoes from Aunt Nellie down the road, or...
Yeah, the dark side may be indefatigable, but it's also not all that smart. They can't figure out how to manage something as multidimensional and complex as a human society.
Yeah, it does contain within itself the seeds of its own destruction and the ways to overcome it.
Right.
It does. So I say, give them more rope. Let them strangle themselves.
Well, let's wrap it up, because we're about on an hour now. Okay. What, you know, the idea of horror and supernatural and these types of things, it's this inherently conservative genre. I think Russell Kirk talked about that, because it presupposes good and it presupposes evil, and it usually presupposes a supernatural moral order. Yeah. I mean, as the people who wrote this book, I mean, what do you think is its real importance? What was the thing that really made you feel like you had to do this? You had this need to get it out.
We had a need to wake up some of those sleepwalkers. We hope that this is a story that will be interesting enough to capture the moral imagination, as Russell
said. And to just give them something to think about. And we wrote it with the idea that we wrote it for every man. We didn't write it for, you know, PhDs and graduates from Yale and Princeton and Harvard. We wrote it with a very simple language, but also we wanted it to be interesting enough where you'd get through it. It's like a plane ride from here to Austin, Texas. You can read this book. We wanted to shake people up and say, pay attention. Look what could go on. Look what's happening. And then it started happening. You know, it's like, wow, maybe we were too late. But anyway, we wrote it with the idea that it was for every man, every woman to read and maybe think about stuff. Think about their place in this, our own personal responsibility. Because it gets back to that, to your own individual. What am I willing to do? What am I willing to stand up for? Why did Dylan finally decide I'm going to write that article anyway and take my hits?
Right. You know, right.
That's what we want people to pay attention to. What are you willing to do to make a difference? Not for you. What about our children or our grandchildren? What about the generations to come? What are they going to inherit?
Right. And I think that's a great place to close it on, because that's what it's all about. Barton and Elizabeth, thank you so much. Book again is The Sacred Fury. I'm James Kirkpatrick, and thank you for listening in.
Thank you, James. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.